The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall bring you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. All right, let's start off with Everyday Miracles. The multiplying dollar. And there's a picture of a whole bunch of bills and coins and such, and a few smiling faces, that type of thing, and they're just lying around looking very comfortable. It was only a dollar, Dylan Belcher noticed on the floor as he sat at the back of his English class at John F. Kennedy High School in Cheektowaga, New York, in March 2018. When the school day ended, Belcher wandered back into the classroom. The wrinkled old bill was still there. He could easily have pocketed it without thinking twice. Instead, he picked it up and brought it to his English teacher, Katie Madison. It wasn't my money, Belcher said, which he sees as ample explanation. Madison, 54, was a little surprised he turned the dollar in, knowing a lot of people would have just kept it. She suggested that Belcher tape it to the whiteboard in front of the classroom, where she always put lost things. Maybe the dollar was lunch money or bus fare for the student who dropped it. You can always tell when someone is looking for something, Madison says. A day or two later, the school shut down for Easter break. Neither the teacher nor her student thought twice about the dollar. Taping it up was just a good karma, says Belcher. Hunter Rose, then a senior, was in English class after break when he spotted the dollar on the whiteboard. There was a mystery to it, Rose said. After class, he asked Madison why it was there. She was still waiting for the original owner to claim it, so she replied, I don't know. Rose took the tape from Madison's desk and taped a second dollar to the board. That got it rolling. The sight of $2 bills, side by side, triggered something in Madison's students. They started asking about the purpose of the money, to which Madison always gave the same answer. She didn't know. At that point, it was absolutely true. More students, intrigued, take up single-dollar bills. Madison, a veteran teacher who recognized the phenomenon in the making, wrote the initials of each student on each specific bill, and she started to leave the tape on the tray of the whiteboard. The effort snowballed. Even with no specific purpose, many students wanted to be part of whatever this was. Jake Braniecki, another senior, says everyone understood that the eventual plan for the dollars would be for something good, and that their teacher wasn't going to do anything stupid with the money. The students, among themselves, decided Madison had some unspoken goal, some mysterious threshold at which she would reveal the secret. They figured bigger donations could only help them get there faster. Bernicke tapped a $20 bill and a $10 bill to the whiteboard. Megan Mikowski dug into her Christmas and birthday savings and taped up another $20. I kept pestering her the whole time, she said of her teacher. The amount continued to grow over several weeks until it reached $175.76. As for the original dollar, the person who lost it never came looking. That left Madison to decide upon the best resolution. She kept thinking about her brother-in-law, Jack Haynes, a guy she described as a wonderful human being who had been godfather to Madison's daughter, Tess. 8 years earlier, Jack had died of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, a rare and devastating neurological disease. 3 years after that, his sister, Jean Haynes Grant, died of the same conditions. Madison told that story to all her classes. She explained that Jack had been married to her sister, Terry Stephen Haynes, and that Terry raises money every spring for the ALS Therapy Development Institute, established to seek a cure for the disease. She asked the teens whether they minded if she donated the dollars in their names in honor of Jack. Their answer was to tape enough money to the whiteboard over the next few days to push the amount to $321.06. Madison, choking back tears as she recalls the moment, shares she carefully peeled the cash off the board and made the donation just before the beginning of May, which is National ALS Awareness Month. That was Saturday. By Monday afternoon, eight more dollars had been taped to the board. Editor's note. After this story was published in the Buffalo News, JFK High School graduates, Madison's fellow teachers, and other members of the community sent Madison's more donations. By the end of the school year, they'd raised more than $1,300. That was a special moment in time with a special group of kids who were intrigued by the mystery of what was unfolding and wanted to be a part of it, Madison said. It's a sweet story. Too smart for your own good. I've got these gifted children, and I want to know how long it is before I can re-gift them. The Genius Special. Laugh yourself smarter. Humor activates our brains and enhances our well-being, perhaps more than anything else. E.B. White once wrote, humor can be dissected as a frog can, but the thing dies in the process. Might not be true after all. By day, Ori Amir is a mild-mannered 30-something college professor. He teaches undergraduate psychology and neuroscience classes, conducts research into how the brain functions, and holds regular office hours on the leafy campus of Pomona College in Southern California. But his students aren't fooled. They've seen the YouTube videos, the ones that document his not-so-secret other life. In one of them, Amir is gripping a microphone and standing center stage at the 1,300-seat Alex Theater in Glendale, California. Wearing a striped rugby shirt, faded blue jeans, tattered construction boots, and a ridiculous shaggy white fur coat. It's the second night of the Glendale Laughs Comedy Festival, and Amir is grinning madly at the audience through his ample beard, looking like a crazed 6'2", red-headed Fozzie Bear. As you can tell by my accent, I'm a neuroscientist, says Amir, who grew up in Israel. They tell the professors at the university where I work to dress business casual. This is pretty much the best I can do. My wardrobe ranges from very casual to inappropriate. Tonight, he is wearing a full spectrum. Amir likes to tell his audiences, and occasionally his students, that his dream is to become a professional comedian and an amateur neurosurgeon. That way I could cut up brains for fun. In fact, he has already managed to combine these seemingly unrelated passions. Amir is one of the leading researchers studying the way the brain creates and understands humor. Unless you happen to be a neuroscientist who moonlights as a stand-up, that especially might seem trivial compared with other fields of cognition. But the question of why we find things funny has fascinated philosophers for centuries. This is a particularly exciting time for Amir and his fellow humor researchers. It has only been in the past few years that scanning technologies such as functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, have let us see how the brain works when it is processing information. Which parts do what, and what benefits might accrue from exercising different areas? It turns out that joking, long dismissed by some as frivolous diversions from the serious business of reality, may make us smarter and healthier. There is even some evidence that a sense of humor helps the human species survive. And there's a picture of Amir, and he's definitely interesting. He's got a red beard and goatee, long reddish hair, and he's holding a Groucho Marx mask up in front of his face. To understand why humor is kind of superficial for the brain, it helps to know what our brains crave in the first place. You might think they're preferred when we sit alone in a room and stare at a blank wall. We don't burn up much energy doing that. But the brain is like a muscle, and it needs exercise. What gives the brain a workout? Information. When the researchers asked people to look at a series of pictures while their brains were being scanned in an fMRI machine, it was the more complex images, a work of art, a sprawling vista, a group of animals that tickled the neurons in their heads most. It's the activation of those neurons, nerve cells, which, among other things, send and receive sensory information, that light up the fMRI scans in bright, almost psychedelic colors. In fact, there's an almost drug-like effect taking place. The brain is filled with opioid receptors, yes, opioid, as in the drug. Made of specialized proteins, these receptors poke out of our neurons like tiny radio antennas, designed to pick up passing signals. When the right kind of molecule bumps into a receptor, perhaps one of the body's naturally recurring opioids, such as an endomorphin or a synthetic drug designed to look like one, such as heroin or morphine, it can kick off a cascade of brain activity that bathes the neurons in feel-good neurotransmitters and other chemicals. The more neurons that are activated, and the more activated they are, the more pleasure we feel. In essence, learning and problem-solving get us high. Amir and his mentor, University of Southern California professor of neuroscience and psychology, Irving Biderman, suspected that humor might feed the brain in much the same way that complex information does. People who study humor generally agree that most jokes are built around an incongruity, an inappropriate, absurd, surprising, or unusual combination of two fundamentally different ideas or elements. To wit, a 6'2" neuroscientist in a fluffy fur coat and scruffy construction boots. When are the first we see or hear this mashup? We're confused. That's the setup. The punchline is the resolution of that confusion. Oh, this is his idea of business casual? Waka, waka, waka. So in that sense, appreciating humor is not unlike solving a puzzle, and it yields a similar kind of satisfaction. Instead of an aha moment, you get a ha-ha moment. In fact, Biederman and Ammer theorized that because humor requires the brain to process lots of distinct type of information, isn't it too hot in Southern California to dress up in so many layers? What is considered appropriate business attire? Is it ever okay to wear fur? Funny revelations would activate different, more disparate parts of the brain and unfunny ones. This would excite the neurons even more, which would lead to the release of more neuron transmitters and the activation of the reward centers of the brain. To test their hypotheses, Ammer and Biederman recruited 15 students to view 200 simple line drawings during an fMRI scan. Each drawing came with two captions, an obvious description and an interpretive one. For a picture with three T's in a row, the obvious caption read, "Thick, T-shaped junctions." An interpretive caption might read, "Trumpet valves," because the three T's represent the finger buttons on a trumpet. Some of the interpretive captions were designed to be funny. In a drawing of two horizontal ovals wedged inside a vertical line, the obvious caption read, "Two smaller horizontal ellipses in a larger vertical ellipse." The interpretive funny description, "Close-up of a pig looking at a book in the library." Think about it, or look at the drawing. There's a drawing to the right. It shows that. For another drawing, a plethora of dots surrounded concentrically around a single dot could be just that, or it could be germs avoiding a friend who caught antibiotics. The subjects were asked to rate each caption as not funny, a little funny, or funny. As expected, the interpretive captions lit up more amount areas of the brain than their obvious counterparts, in line with the cognitive theory that insight in and of itself is pleasurable. But the scans revealed that humorous insights activated the most regions of all. The funnier the subjects rated a caption, the more neurons were fired. It is this extra burst of brain activation at the moment we get a joke that transforms a ha into ha-ha. Ammer and Biederman concluded, what's more, the opioid receptors they were studying are located in the higher level of the processing areas of the temporal lobes. A patch of neural real estate running through roughly behind the ears up to the eyes, where we store the memories and associations we use to make sense of the world. They also have a connection to neurons in the basal ganglia, the reward center of the brain. We had come to think these perpetual systems as relatively mundane instructions meant to simplify, passively get us information, Biederman says. But it turns out that getting new information is actually pleasurable. From there, the researchers took their analysts one step further. In a follow-up study, Ammer recruited people to compose captions for a series of cartoons while he scanned their brains. When they came up with a joke, the same regions of the brain that light up when people appreciate humor were activated. And, as the first study, the funnier the jokes, as rated by independent observers, the more neurons fired in the joker's brains. But the firing of the brain cells occurred on a different timeline, enhancing the process and making it all the more powerful. When we get a joke, the neurons are activated in a quick burst. When we construct a joke, activity in the same brain regions increases slowly as we rack our brains for dissimilar elements we can link. If appreciating humor is a good exercise for our brain, then writing a joke is exercise on steroids. Humor helps our cognition in less obvious ways, too. Laughter is a natural stress reliever, and our brains work better when we aren't slowed down by a fog of worry. In 2014, researchers in California demonstrated that elderly subjects who watched a funny video experienced significant improvement in their ability to learn and retain new information, possibly because if feelings of mirth reduced level of cortisol, a stress hormone that has been shown to hinder recall. A good joke can function as a release valve for the whole body. Humor can help reframe stresses, challenges, or difficulties that seem insurmountable to a person, says Tom Ford, a social psychologist at Western Carolina University and a co-author of The Psychology of Humor. If one is able to make light of a stressor or challenge, then it doesn't seem so big. It seems more manageable. Researchers in Hong Kong, for instance, demonstrated that when nursing home patients with chronic pain enjoyed jokes, funny books and videos, and goofy singing and dancing on a weekly basis, their perception of pain and loneliness decreased significantly. They also felt happier and more satisfied with life. Others have demonstrated that laughter can be associated with increased blood flow, improved immune response, lower blood sugar levels, and better sleep. Doesn't have to write a joke to reap the benefits. Merely experienced humor will do the trick. Hang on a second, I'm scrolling here. Charlie Chaplin's Good Humor Theory. In a 1920 prototype of Reader's Digest, film legend Charlie Chaplin shared the surprising minimalist craft that went into his Hollywood hits. To make an audience roar is the ambition of many actors, but I prefer to spread the laughs out. It is much better when there is a continual ripple of amusement with one or two big stomach laughs than when the audience explodes every minute or two. Restraint is a great word, not only for actors, but also for everybody to remember. Restraint of tempers, appetites, desires, bad habits, and so on is a mighty good thing to cultivate. How to be funnier. Are you humor challenged? Do the bon mots not trickle off your tongue but clunk? Experts share their tips on strengthening your funny bone. Question everything. Let the absurdities of everyday life be your muse. Jerry Seinfeld made his career wondering, why does this happen? Example, why does Morshant ruin leather? Aren't cows outside a lot of the time? Get the blood flowing. Funny people tend to be more creative, according to brainpickings.org, and to get their juices flowing, creative types get moving. Dickens and Hugo were avid walkers during ideation. Burns often composed while holding the plow. Twain paced madly while dictating. Goody and Scott composed on horseback. Mozart preferred the back of a carriage. He might have also liked this gag. Why couldn't Mozart find his teacher? Because he was Haydn. H-A-Y-D-N. Hidden, I guess that's supposed to be pronounced. Don't worry, be happy. The myth of Moreau's comic notwithstanding, happy people are funnier, says research in Austin, Austria. Increased depression, they write, is associated with greater problems in the use of humor to cope with the stressful events. Fortunately, good humor can be contagious. The researcher also found that cheerful people tend to laugh more, which can help you feel funnier, even if you are prone to telling crony cheesy jokes such as this. Which side of a duck has the most feathers? The outside. Make it snappy. My building blocks are little jokes and short ideas, explains comedian Dimitri Martin. Example, the worst time to have a heart attack is during a game of charades. That's funny. Surprises work. Lead the audience to assume one thing, then surprise them with something different, comedy coach Jerry Corley writes on standupcomedyclinic.com. For example, never say anything bad about a man until you've walked a mile in his shoes. By then, he's a mile away, you've got his shoes, and you can say whatever you want. Go easy on yourself. If you try these tips and the room still isn't erupting into laughter every time you open your mouth, fear not. While creating humor exercises your brain the most, simply appreciating a good joke or a funny story brings with it ample benefits for your health. But there might also be a stronger reason that a sense of humor is hardwired into the human genome. Not only does humor make us smarter and healthy, but it also makes us more attractive to the opposite sex. There's a gigantic study, Biederman notes, that's been done in 38 cultures. It turns out that in every culture, both males and females desire their potential mate to be bright. But we don't have our IQs tattooed on our forehead. How do we know someone's intelligent? In Western cultures, at least, it's often in the person's sense of humor. Because creating and appreciating jokes both requires us to make connections between many discrete pieces of information, Having a sense of humor demonstrates that we possess a wide breadth of knowledge and that we know how to think about it in novel and innovative ways. Take Amir's and Biederman's favorite cartoon, for example. A mouse is standing outside his house, having just pulled a gun on a cat, who is depicted with one paw raised in mock submission. 6 rounds, 9 lives. You do the math, the cat says. In order to appreciate this joke, you need to know that the mice are usually the victims of cats. Many revolvers are 6 bullets, and cats are said to have 9 lives because of their ability to always land on their feet. You also need to be able to subtract 6 from 9 to understand that the cat has the upper hand, or paw, in the case may be, in this scene after all. A University of New Mexico study of 400 college students found that those who scored higher on intelligence tests also scored high on humor ability, and they reported having more sex. This confirmed a wide body of literature that the success of humor is not just a reliable intelligent indicator, but maybe one of the most important traits for seeking human mates. Being funny is not only a powerful sign of smarts, it also makes potential mates feel good, and by ensuring that only the cleverest, fittest, and most creative people procreate, it helps safeguard the survival of the human race. Humor has several unique powers, says Amir. It forces people to consider different perspectives. It brings people together. If they are laughing together on something, they must agree with each other on some level. It reduces the pain associated with life's difficulties. It exercises your brain and it makes you happy. If a healthy sense of humor can make you smarter, sexier, and happier, then one thing is clear: finding time in your day for a good joke or two is no laughing matter. Laugh facts. Laughter has surprisingly little to do with jokes and humor. Most laughter does not come from listening to funny stories. Robert Provine, a neuroscientist from the University of Maryland, found that we're 30 times more likely to laugh at something when we are talking to our friends, even if what they're saying isn't really funny. In this instance, laughter helps communicate to our conversational partners that we like and empathize with them. In other cases, we may use laughter to disguise our nervousness or to ease our tension. It's not just humor that makes a joke funny. People find jokes funnier when they are told by someone they know, especially if they consider that person funny. A clever cartoon, explains Bob Mankoff, the humor and cartoon editor at Esquire, seems even funny if there are also other variables we like the drawing is good or the comedian is one we admire or a person we don't like is being put down. It will not help if you lose weight, sorry. While laughter has been shown to improve your health in many ways, it does not burn more calories than going for a run, sadly. Although laughing does raise a person's energy expenditure and heart rate by about 10 to 20%. You would have to laugh solidly for up to 3 hours to burn off a bag of potato chips. Humans aren't the only ones who do it. Researchers in England spent several months with captive chimpanzee colonies and found that the primates laughed all the time. Usually the laughter came from spontaneous reactions to physical contact, such as wrestling, chasing, tickling, or just being surprised. Others have found evidence that rats laugh, a high-pitched, ultrasonic kind of way, though our rat pups laugh far more than adults. It's a universal language. Laughter sounds basically the same in every culture, leading some researchers to believe that laughter somehow connected our human ancestors whenever they encountered each other. In fact, according to the University of Kentucky, the sound of laughter is so common and familiar that it can be recognized if played backwards. Hot water with hops. In Milwaukee, even the nuns are in the beer business. This year, School Sisters of St. Francis opened a summer beer garden to raise money for clean water projects in Peru and India. Among their top sellers, a pale brew called Ale Mary. Now that's funny. So let's close out the Reader's Digest today with a little bit of humor in uniform. While serving on the USS Fulton, AS-11, in New London, Connecticut, a fellow sailor and I were topside. He leaned over the railing and opened his mouth to say something. As he did, his uppers fell out and sank to the bottom of the Thames River. He didn't seem too bothered, though. "That's okay," he said. "My serial number's engraved on them." When my daughter had her baby, I flew down to the Naval Air Station in Kingsville, Texas, where her husband was stationed, to help. My first job was to figure out why there was no hot water. I found the water heater and soon discovered the problem. It was set too low, so I raised it. My daughter was so impressed with that she bragged to her husband that I'd fixed the water heater. He said, well, I don't know anything about water heaters. I'm a jet engine mechanic. Last week on Consumer Reports, we were talking about major appliances, and we went over how long they'll last and the other aspects of the appliances, but we didn't get to how to care for all your major appliances. Appliances can be expensive, and once they're installed and up and running, it's easy to forget, like any complex machine, appliances require some regular TLC. That's why we put together a list of 26 maintenance tips so it will keep the unsung workhorses of your kitchen and laundry room happy and humming along for years to come. Refrigerators. Vacuum the condenser coils. Condenser coils collect dust, dirt, hair, grime, and other debris that can restrict their ability to dissipate heat, limiting efficiency and potentially causing a breakdown. Every 6 months, gently vacuum the coils using a soft brush attachment to keep them working at their best. They're on the underside or rear of the refrigerator, on top for built-ins, so you'll have a pop off the grill or pull the bridge out from the cabinets to get to them. Keep the door gaskets clean. The gaskets around the refrigerator doors keep cold air from escaping, but spills and food bits can build up and prevent them from forming a good seal. That forces the compressor to work harder than it should, said Joseph Pacello, who runs CR Refrigerator Test Lab. Clean the gaskets with a damp sponge or cloth and be sure to dry off excess water, which won't have a chance to evaporate in the folds of the gasket when the door closes. If you notice any mold, you'll need something to kill it, such as a disinfectant cleanser. Check your fridge manual first to see whether certain products should be avoided. Change the water filter. If your fridge has a water filter, replace it every 6 months. Be wary of aftermarket filters because it's tricky to verify whether they remove contaminants and bacteria from your drinking water. On the other hand, if you're confident that your water supply is safe and you don't want to spend an extra $100 or so per year on filters, you can probably just go without one. With certain refrigerators, you'll need to insert a cartridge plug to keep the water flowing. It should have come with the fridge. How to clean a Ranger's control panel. Carefully dampen a lint-free rag with a warm soapy water and wipe it down. Don't spray the panel directly or soak it because water slips past the seal. It can fry the electronics inside the panel. Same goes for your microwave. Ranges. Clean up cooktop spills. Get other spills as soon as you're finished. Get after spills as soon as you're finished cooking and the cooktop has cooled. Burned-on spills become harder to remove, and sugary spills can damage the glass smooth-top surface, says Tara Cosmicola. Boy, that's a name. Casaregola, who runs CR's range test lab. On a gas range, spills can clog ignition ports, preventing burners from lighting properly. Remove the electric coils or on gas ranges the grates and burner caps, then wipe away the bulk of the spill with paper towels and sponge off the rest with warm soapy water. You can wash removable parts of gas burners in the sink and with soapy water, then rinse and dry them. Electric coils should be cleaned with a damp cloth. She says not to rinse them in water. For smooth tops, use a liquid cooktop cleaner and paper towels or a ceramic cooktop cleaning pad. Then buff out the residue with a clean towel. Keep your smooth top smooth. Remember that your cooktop is made of glass, so to avoid scratching or cracking it, don't fling cookware around like you're a Swedish chef. Use flat-bottom pots and pans only, and lift and place them rather than sliding or plucking them down. Use the oven self-clean cycle. Remove everything from your oven, including the racks, which can warp in the extreme heat up to 850 degrees Fahrenheit, generated through the cycle. Turn on the range hood, crack open the kitchen windows, and allow the cycle to run completely, about 2 to 6 hours. Once the oven cools, wipe away any residue with a sponge and warm water. Self-cleaning regular may curb the temperature to line the oven with foil to catch spillovers. Foil is a big no-no, Condriola says. It can melt in place and you'll never get it all. Dishwashers. Degunk the door seal. As needed, clean the seal between the dishwasher door and the tub, where residue and food particles collect. Buildup can cause odors, lead to mold growth, and potentially keep the door from sealing properly. Rust-proof the racks. If the plastic coating wears off, repair it as soon as possible with vinyl paint or replacement tine tips. Otherwise, the racks could corrode and allow small shards of rusty metal to enter the pump, according to Chris Ziesel, technical service supervisor at RepairClinic.com. Remove hard water residue. If you live in an area with hard water, the inside of your dishwasher is likely to develop mineral films and a discoloration. These deposits look like a cloudy film on your dishes and the interior of your machine, and you may notice the rack rolls, rails, and wheels moving with resistance, according to Adman Hoffman, Director of Dishwasher Engineering at GE Appliances. Manufacturers recommend using a citric acid-based dishwasher cleaner and as a fresh or finish to remove the deposits monthly. Follow package directions for removing both hard water film from your dishwasher. Inspect the spray arms. Every few months, check the holes in the wash arms, spray nozzles, to make sure that they're clean and unobstructed. If you see food debris clogging a spray nozzle, generally try to remove it with a toothpick or pipe cleaner. You want to be gentle and make sure not to deform the holes, says Larry Chufa, who runs CR's dishwasher test lab. It can affect the spray pattern and how well the dishwasher does its job. Over-the-range OTR microwaves. Be quick with the cleanup. Sponge up spills as soon as they occur. Bits of food left behind can absorb some of the microwave's energy when you turn it on again, creating a hot spot that can damage the interior. Take special care not to scratch the protective mesh inside the door if it's exposed, because it prevents microwaves from escaping and zapping you. Turn on the exhaust fan. An OTR's exhaust fan is not as efficient as a range hood's, but you should use it anyway. Many times the user will not turn on the exhaust when cooking on the range cooktop, causing the moisture rising from pots and pans to collect at the electronics of the microwave, and shorter its lifespan, says Wayne Archer, a technical expert at Sears in Home Services. If moisture collects, wipe it off with a paper towel or soft cloth. While you're underneath the microwave, check the grease filters to make sure they're not gunked up, and blocking airflow. If they are, soak them in a sink full of hot water and a degreasing dish detergent, such as Dawn. Dry and reinstall. Don't slam the door. Your microwave door has 3, sometimes 4, safety interlock switches that disable the oven when the door is open. For the microwave to work properly, the switches have to line up with the corresponding latches when the door is closed. All door strikes, latch mechanisms, and door switches themselves are plastic, so slamming the microwave door can physically break any of these components, Zeller says. The series of switches will all have to work in unison. Damage to any of the switches and latches could render the microwave inoperable. That's scary. I didn't know that. Do not attempt to repair the electronics yourself. Not that you necessarily would, but in case you're tempted, consider that the Consumer Product Safety Commission has reported that people have been electrocuted trying to repair their microwaves. A microwave can hold an electrical charge of thousands of volts in its capacitors for hours and even days after it has been unplugged, according to RepairClinic.com. A capacitor is a component that stores energy and releases it when needed, Zessler says. This energy can be released when touched by a person. RepairClinic.com advises leaving such repairs to a pro, but get an estimate first. It's an expensive repair, and it may cost less to replace the machine. How to clean a dishwasher filter. All those food scraps have to go somewhere, and unless your dishwasher is an old-school food grinder, you'll have to clean the filter manually, says Adam Hoffman at GE says, to do it every month or so, more often if necessary. If there is a decrease in wash performance or dishes feel gritty, then this is also can be an indication that filters need to be cleaned, he says. Remove the bottom rack, and you should find a plastic cylinder that you can unscrew to lift it out. If it's not there, consult your manual. Rinse the filter under running water until it's free of debris. It's fine to use that soft sponges and warm soapy water for stubborn food bits, but abrasive brushes or steel wool can damage the filter. And if you find any holes, replace the filter immediately. That's because if hard objects such as seeds or bits of bone make it past the filter and enter the pump, they can damage the pump impeller and motor seals, a costly repair. Washing machines. Keep it level. The drums on modern washers can pin up to 1600 RPM. To keep the machine from vibrating excessively and damaging itself, the washer needs to sit dead level with its feet firmly on the floor. If your washer is unsteady, extend 1 foot at a time, says Richard Handel, who runs CR's Laundry Appliance Test Lab. Once the washer feels stable, use a level to check it front and back, side to side. Adjust as necessary, then tighten the lock nuts on the feet. Don't overdo it on detergent. A surplus of suds makes the washer work harder and could trigger extra rinse cycles, extending wash time and wasting energy and lifespan. Here's the correct type of detergent in the amount recommended by your washer's manual. Newer washers use a lot less water than those made 15 years ago, and high-efficiency HE detergents would produce less suds are formulated to work with water-saving front loaders. HE top loaders are even certain and even certain agitator top loaders. Clean the dispenser drawer. Remove it and clean it on a routine basis. When the detergent builds up in the dispenser, it can cause suds galore, making the washer work harder. Inspect the water fill hoses. Replace when cracked or brittle. If a hose bursts, the flood can damage your appliances and flood for starters. Oh, and here's something I missed. Oh, I'm sorry. We already read that. My apologies. Dryers. Clean the lint trap. It may seem obvious, but this is something to do before every load to ensure that the air flows freely. A blocked lint trap requires the dryer to run longer, added to the wear and tear on the machine. And I'll put a personal anecdote in this. I had my dryer was spinning, and it looked like it was working, but my clothes weren't getting dry. And it turned out that the people outside my apartment, I live in an apartment, had painted the thing, and they'd accidentally painted my vent things. They had little flaps. They painted so two of them were sealed with the paint. And that made my dryer not work efficiently, and my clothes weren't getting dry. The maintenance guy came, looked at it, took one look, popped the little things open, and it worked fine. So it's important to keep the duct clear. If lint builds up at the point where it restricts airflow, your clothes won't dry. And conditions are ripe for a dryer fire, and I have a friend whose house burned down because of that. Disconnect the duct from the dryer, then vacuum the dryer vent with a long-handled attachment. Next, use a special brush made for cleaning dryer ducts. Feed it into the duct, vacuuming out chunks of lint as you move it back and forth. Where possible, separate the duct into shorter sections for better access, as Handel says. If you don't feel comfortable doing it yourself, you can call a dryer vent cleaning service. How to guard against mold in a washer. Mold thrives when it has food and water, and washers provide plenty of both, with detergent residues serving as one food source. Try these tips. Air out the interior of your washer. Between loads, keep a front loader's door ajar, as long as young children aren't afoot, and a top loader's lid open. Open the dispensers partially to give them the opportunity to dry. Prevent residue buildup by using the proper amount and type of detergent. Run the tub clean feature regularly. The recommended frequency varies by machine, from once a month to every 50 cycles. If your washer doesn't have a run empty load on the hottest setting with a cup of bleach instead of detergent, get in the habit of wiping away moisture. Inside a front loader's door and the rubber gasket, while you're at it, gently pull back the gasket to clean away any residue and dry the surface. And here's an important issue for everybody. Secrets to credit score success. A lower or inaccurate credit score can have costly consequences. Here's how to keep track of your score and get it as high as possible, and to keep it that way. If you think your credit history determines only the interest rates you get on a home mortgages, car loans, and credit cards, you'd be wrong. But you certainly wouldn't be alone. In a recent U.S. News and World Report survey, less than half of the 1,497 respondents knew that in many states, poor credit could lead to higher income, higher home and auto insurance rates, or being denied an apartment. CR opposes the use of credit reports for these purposes. The consequences go even further. Employers in many areas can use credit reports to vet job candidates, and having a low credit score could mean paying $4,000 more for a typical car loan or $200,000 more for credit over the course of a lifetime than someone with a high credit score. And they've got a breakdown here of the different scores and three digits that define your financial life. Leaders and landlords can use your FICO score and other credit-based scores to determine your interest rates and whether or not to rent to you. The higher interest rates offered to consumers with low FICO scores could mean they could pay almost $100,000 more for a 30-year fixed-rate home loan than consumers who have a higher score and qualify for lower interest rates. 800 or above is exceptional. 740 to 799 is very good. 670 to 739 is good. 580 to 669 is fair, and below 580 is poor. There are several types of credit scores, but the FICO score is one of the most widely used by lenders, which makes it a good barometer of your overall creditworthiness. According to the Fair Isaac Corporation, which creates more than a dozen versions of the score for various types of lenders, all of them are based on assorted forms of credit data, such as payment history and amounts owed, provided by the three major credit bureaus, Experian, TransUnion, and Equifax. Each form of credit data is given a different weight. Finding your credit score can be a frustrating process if you don't know where to look. The Fair Isaac Corporation and credit reporting agencies will provide your FICO score for a fee, but there are several ways to find it at no charge. For instance, if your bank credit card issuer or lender participates in FICO score, open access, you may be able to get it free just by logging into your account. Discover which is among the cards to provide FICO scores to its cardholders. We'll also provide the scores at no cost to non-customers who share information, including a Social Security number, which the company says it will protect from misuse. Though it does not provide the actual score, FICO's free credit scores estimator provides a range of when a consumer score is likely to fall, based on answers to 10 questions. The estimator can be found at myfico.com/free-credit-score-range-estimator. Making sense of your score. FICO scores typically range from a low of 300 to a high of 850. The national average FICO score is 704. And generally, a score above 800 will qualify you for the lowest interest rates, though even a score in the high 600s should qualify for a favorable rate. Experian, one of three major credit bureaus, defines the boundaries this way. 800 plus, exceptional. Less than 1% of borrowers in this range are likely to become seriously delinquent. They'll easily be approved for the lowest rates. 740 to 799, very good. 1% of borrowers in this category are likely to become seriously delinquent. They could be offered the lowest rates from lenders, but it's not a given. 670 to 739 is good. 8% could become seriously delinquent. This stratum includes the average U.S. credit score. People in this range are considered an acceptable lending risk. 580 to 669 is fair. An estimated 27% of the people in this group could become seriously delinquent, making them likely to candidates for subprime loans at higher rates. 579 and below, poor. This group is considered a poor lending risk. Roughly 62% become seriously delinquent. They will be eligible only for the highest interest rates, if they can get any credit at all. Though missing just one payment can ding your score, even a major downturn in your luck or behavior is unlikely to drop it into the very lowest range. Bruce W. McClary, Vice President of Communications at the National Foundation for Credit Counseling, a group that represents nonprofit credit counseling agencies, says the lowest score he's ever seen was a 425 for a consumer who had already been in bankruptcy and was delinquent with several creditors. Obsessing over perfecting your score might be a waste of time, says Katie Ross, Education and Development Manager for American Consumer Credit Counseling, a nonprofit that offers guidance to consumers. Instead, focus your efforts on keeping it within a healthy range, she says. The five keys to your credit scores. FICO scores are based on the following factors supplied by credit reporting agencies. 35% is based on your payment history. 30% is on the amount of debt. 15% the length of the credit history. 10% on your credit mix. And 10% on requests for new credit. 10 ways to raise your credit score. Taking these actions can help to raise a sagging score. Just don't expect it to happen overnight. Depending on the reason for a poor score, it could take from 12 to 24 months to see a difference. Regularly monitor your credit reports. Mistakes on your credit reports can be costly and are common. A study by the Federal Trade Commission found that 1 in 5 consumers had an error on his or her credit report that was corrected after it was disputed. Consumers are entitled to receive 3 free credit reports each year, one from each of the three major credit reporting agencies, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion. A smart way to monitor their credit is to go to annualcreditreport.com and request a free report from a different agency every 4 months. Common errors to look for include credit accounts that are reflected duplicate credit accounts, debts incurred by a former spouse, and bad debts older than 7 years. You can initiate a dispute online at each of the 3 major credit reporting agencies. Pay your bills on time, number 2. Approximately 35% of the FICO score is determined by your payment history, and 90% of those with the highest FICO scores have no missed payments. It's better to pay the minimum on credit cards each month than to fall behind. Number 3. Don't apply for several credit cards at once. This generates numerous inquiries into your credit history, which may lower your score. Another reason, opening several new credit accounts at the same time reduces the average age of your accounts, which can also lower your credit score. However, multiple requests within a 45-day period for a single type of credit, mortgage, auto loan, or student loan, for instance, are counted as a single inquiry to allow consumers to shop around for the best rate. These are less likely to lower your score. Number 4. Don't cancel unused cards unless they carry an annual fee. Roughly a third of your score is based on the ratio of credit used to a total available credit. Eliminating a card will lower your available credit, and you can work against you. Number 5. Keep credit balances low. Because a high credit ratio can negatively affect your score, maintaining a low revolving credit balance is wise. Most people with the highest FICO scores owe less than $3,000 on revolving accounts. Number 6. If you charge everything in a rewards card for the points, switch to a cash or debit card for a couple of months before applying for new credit. Even if you pay your balances in full every month, a lot of debt relative to your credit limit can still be viewed negatively. Number 7. Maintain a variety of credit types. Successfully paying, say, an auto loan, a student loan, and a credit card bills over the same period so that you're able to juggle different types of credit. That diversification accounts for 10% of your score. Number 8. Pay off all debt in collection. With the most current version of FICO score, debt that referred to a collections agency but has been paid off will no longer count against you. Always dispute any debt that has been wrongly assigned to you. Number 9. Get a secured credit card after bankruptcy. If you've been through bankruptcy, using a secured credit card backed by a refundable deposit may be an effective way to start rebuilding your credit. A bankruptcy will have less impact on your score over time if you don't default on new loans. It may be a while before you can access credit inexpensively again. Chapter 7 and Chapter 13 bankruptcies stay on your credit for up to 10 years. Number 10. Consider new tools that can boost your credit score. Consumers with little credit history or less than stellar scores may now use 2 new tools that could boost creditworthiness by taking into account additional information such as utility or mortgage payments and bank balances. For the pros and cons of these, see if you need extra help improving your score, which is on the next page, which we will turn to in just a moment. If you need extra help improving your score, most consumers with the highest FICO scores have more than 25 years of demonstrated credit history, according to the Fair Isaac Corporation, which creates the score. But simply establishing credit can present consumers with a predicament. You can't get credit without proving creditworthiness, but it's difficult to prove creditworthiness without first having credit. To help solve this chicken and egg challenge, and also to give consumers a lower credit scores a chance to raise them, Fair Isaac Corp and the credit reporting company Experian each recently introduced services that give consumers the choice to have non-traditional financial data factored into their credit scores. Consumer advocates say they see the value of helping people who have thin or poor credit histories qualify for credit. But they also voice concern that more lenient credit scoring and lending standards could allow consumers to take on more debt than they can afford, and caution that this could lead to a repeat of the subprime housing market meltdown of 2008, which forced millions into foreclosure. While incorporating bank transaction data into credit scores could help raise those of some consumers, people should exercise caution before opting to use these services, says Marie Mahoney, a policy analyst for CR, adding that government regulators need to keep a close eye on how the services are implemented. Mahoney says that the fact that these services gives consumers a choice to include private financial data or not is an improvement over the wholesale data collection that happens without our consent. But she suggests consumers proceed with caution. Using these services involves sharing very sensitive banking information with third parties. Consumers should keep in mind that in mind before participating, Mahoney says. Among the questions Mahoney says consumers should ask, how long will my information be collected and kept? How can I discontinue my participation? Will my information be used to fix anything other than credit scoring? Who will it be shared with? Mahoney also says that lenders use many types of credit scores. Even if you see an improvement in your FICO score, that may not be the one that lender considers when making its decision. Here's a summary of the services and how they work. Experian Boost. Consumers who sign up for Experian Boost, which was launched earlier this year, give Experian read-only permission to see their bank account data to review utility, gas, water, and electric, internet, cable, and telecom payments. None of these is typically included in traditional credit reports. Consumers can determine how many qualifying utility, internet, cable, or telecom payments they wish to add to their Experian credit file, and they can turn off the service at any time they wish. Experian researchers show that 64% of consumers who added this additional payment information to their credit report will see their FICO scores improve, says Greg Wright, Chief Product Officer at Experian Consumer Information Services. The improvement is likely to be modest for most consumers, especially those who are already in good financial shape. Still, Experian predicts that 5 to 15% of borrowers will move into a better score category. That could be significant for those who climb from a subprime to a prime category and become eligible for lower interest rates on their loans and lower insurance premiums. UltraFICO. In addition to reviewing any credit history you may have, this service also looks at your bank account to analyze how well you manage your money and factors into your score. UltraFICO takes into account, among other things, how long accounts have been open, frequency of activity, maintaining a savings balance, and avoiding negative balances. Those who bounce check could risk lowering their credit score. As with the data considered by Experian Boost, these factors are not generally included in a traditional credit file. UltraFICO is designed to benefit younger consumers or immigrants who may not be traditional banking customers, as well as those who have experienced previous financial distress and are working to restore their credit worthiness, says David Schellenberger, Vice President of Product Management Scores at FICO. To get a positive rating from the UltraFICO, consumers could, for instance, demonstrate a savings cushion of at least $400 and positive balances during the previous three-month period. Although these aren't hard and fast cutoffs, Schellenberger says the company estimates that about 70% of consumers who maintain those financial goals will benefit from higher credit scores. Fair Isaac Corp. projects 10 to 15 million consumers will participate in UltraFICO, which represents about 20 to 30% of the 53 million consumers previously considered unscorable due to the lack of credit history. At press time, UltraFICO was in a pilot phase. The company predicted it would be available to the general public by the end of the summer of 2019. Creditworthiness is climbing. The national average FICO score, October 2007 to 2010, went from about 686 to 704. But younger consumers still lag behind. The average FICO score by age in April 2018, 30 to 39 years old, 677. I'm sorry, I missed one here. 18 to 29 years old, 659. 40 to 49 years old, 690. 50 to 59 years old, 713. And 60 years or older, 747. What really damages your credit? Experts at the credit reporting agency explain what does and does not get factored into your credit score. Unpaid bills and late payments. Fact. Just one late payment can hurt your score and remain 7 years from the date of the missed payment, said Rod Griffin, Director of Consumer Education and Awareness at Credit Reporting Agency Experian. Unpaid parking and traffic tickets. Myths. Tickets come from municipal records that are no longer collected by any of the credit reporting agencies, Griffin says. Current or unpaid library fines. The library fines, like traffic ticket data, once were collected by credit reporting agencies. They no longer are, Griffin says. Soon-to-be-ex's credit card debt. Fact. You may think you're off the hook if a judge rules that your soon-to-be-ex-spouse must pay all the debt on your joint credit card, but the card company sees it differently. As long as you are still married, you are both jointly and severally liable for 100% of the card debt, says Eric Elman, Senior Vice President for Public Policy and Legal Affairs at the Consumer Data Industry Association, which represents credit reporting agencies. Liens are judgments against you, mostly myth. These infractions rarely make it onto credit reports, Elman says. Liens and other judgments don't show up on credit reports very often, he says, explaining that the only way that those public records to appear on your credit report is for certain personal information from those sources to match what the credit reporting agency has on file. We found that public records will almost never have a Social Security number or date of birth, Elman says. So as a general rule, most liens or judgments don't show up on credit reports. Griffin says unpaid and paid tax liens have been removed from all credit reports. Checking your credit report. Myth. You can look at your credit report as often as you like, but you're entitled to only one free copy per year from the three nationwide credit report bureaus. Sarah recommends that you review a free report every 4 months for accuracies. Inquiries from non-lenders. Myth. A prospective employer may review your credit report, but does not receive the actual credit score and cannot view the credit report without your consent. Insurers and landlords may also request credit reports before issuing a policy or renting to someone. These inquiries have no impact on your credit score. Opening several credit cards. Fact. Opening several credit cards in a short period of time could have a downward effect on your score because it assesses you're in credit trouble, Elman says. Okay, we're getting near to close, so let's do a couple funny things. Chuckle time. I usually meet my girlfriend at 12:59 because I like that one-on-one time. I just found out my mom didn't know how to set the clock on her new microwave, so she stayed up until midnight and then plugged it in. Woke up this morning and the alarm clock was laughing at me. Then I realized it was upside down and the time was actually 7:07. The worst thing about insomnia is discovering all the new hours of the day that you're hungry. And all in a day's work. On our commute to work, my husband stopped at a convenience store for coffee. As he got back into the car, I noticed something odd. "Turn your head and looked at me," I said. "You have a Q-tip sticking out of your ear." As he pulled it out, he replied, "No wonder the guy in there asked me if I was getting good reception." A college girl was visiting my farm and noticed the ring in our bull's nose. Intrigued, she asked, "Did you put that ring in his nose, or was he born that way?" And with that, we've about run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next time, and thanks so much for listening.